Episode number 13 of Bones Are White is brought to you by our good sponsor, Stamps.com. Some small companies think that leasing a postage meter is how businesses get postage for their letters and packages, but they don't realize that there is a better way, and that way is Stamps.com. Because unlike a postage meter, Stamps.com has no hidden fees like meter ink charges or reset charges, no long-term contracts, no extra hardware to buy or lease. Stamps.com can save you up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Plus, Stamps.com can do more than you can with a postage meter, like use your existing address books, send tracking information to recipients with the click of a button. The choice is clear, people. Stamps.com offers more features at a fraction of the cost. That's why we've been using it here at Dark Overlord Media for 5 big fat years. We have shipped literally hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of merchandise with Stamps.com, printing the postage right from our own computers and our own printers. And right now you can have a special offer to use my last name, Sigler, for a no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Sigler. That is Stamps.com. Enter S-I-G-L-E-R. And now on with our story. Welcome to the serialized short story audiobook collection, Bones Are White, by Scott Sigler. Get the stories in Bones Are White for all ebook readers at scottsigler.com/bonesarewhite, or from that same page as a full-length audiobook. You can also buy the ebook version directly from the Kindle Store, the Nook Store, Apple's iBooks, and from Google Play. This book contains harsh language, adult situations, and lots of violence. So if you're easily offended, cue up some Taylor Swift and enjoy. Hello, junkies, and welcome to Bones Are White, episode number 13. Today's story, one of my favorites, it's called Bagman. We've had it on the podcast before, but like a lot of the Bones Are White stories, we did a rewrite, had it edited, put it into our ebook for Bones Are White, have recorded it, and here it is for your listening pleasure. I would call this story more of an intellectual horror story. It's looking at some societal problems and looking at the concept of, are any of us completely innocent of all wrongdoing? And what might happen to you if the definition of punishment for said wrongdoing changes sometime after the fact? Really starts to look at that from a societal level. After this episode, I'm going to tell you about how the MVP hardcover is almost sold out. No, really. And I will have a promo for Liberate, a Continuum podcast. And I will announce the cities for the pandemic book tour. And hopefully you live in one of those cities, or you can move your ass to one of those cities, or just come visit those cities during the tour. After the episode, if you stick around, you'll find out what those cities are. Enough beating around the bush, ladies and gentlemen, let's get into it. Here we go. Bones Are White, episode number 13, Bagman. Enjoy.
Thursday, 9:17 p.m. The phone rang. I pulled myself away from a Seinfeld rerun, picked myself out of my lazy boy, and shuffled toward the cordless. I always put the cordless back in its little holder, so when it rings, I have to go get it anyway. Kind of defeats the purpose of having one, but hey, it was a gift. Hello?
Hello, sir,
said a little boy's voice.
May I please speak to Mr. Frank McMillan?
You're talking at him, I said. I didn't recognize the voice, at least not right off, and I wondered how the kid got the number. I also wondered if I'd have to change it again. I'd changed it 4 times in the past 3 months. The price of stardom, I suppose, and the price of writing newspaper articles that piss people off.
This is Frank McMillan?
The voice asked. Yes, kid, this is Frank McMillan. Who is this? The pause was only slight.
Good evening, Mr. McMillan,
the kid's voice said.
This is the Bagman.
My knees went instantly weak, and I felt like I'd been kicked dead square in the nuts. My head swam. I needed a deep breath but couldn't draw one. I shuffled for the Lazy Boy, grateful it was only 5 feet away. Cordless gadgets come in handy after all. Kid, is this some kind of sick fucking joke? I fell back into the chair, breathless and weak.
No, sir,
the tiny voice said.
No, sir, this is no joke. You've heard enough of the police tapes, Mr. McMillan. I think you recognize my voice by now.
No, I don't recognize it. Somewhere in my head, it seemed that if I knew the voice, if I believed the call was real, then I was accepting my own doom. But that was irrelevant, because I knew damn well who it was. I don't know who the fuck this is, but you're not funny.
That may be the case, Mr. McMillan, but I assure you, I am the bagman. You're in denial now. It will pass. I'll be paying you a visit tomorrow at 3 p.m.
I'd heard such conversations before, but those were recordings. Recordings of other people. He was talking to me now. And that was a whole different story. I wondered how he could be so fucking polite. He sounded like he was drumming up candy sales for the local Little League team, not announcing my death warrant. You've made a mistake, I said.
Claudette.
I still couldn't breathe, and my words were more puffs of frightened air than an actual voice. Really, I think you've made a mistake.
That's not the case, Mr. McMillan. We both know that. I'll see you tomorrow. Tell the police the code is Tweety Sylvester Daffy. Can you remember that, sir?
Tweety Sylvester Daffy. My mortality spelled out in Looney Tunes characters. I had no doubt the cops would have the same code.
Goodbye, Mr. McMillan. Have a pleasant evening.
I heard a click, then a dial tone. The phone dropped from my hands and fell noiselessly on the shag carpeting. On the TV, Kramer burst through the door. The crowd roared in delight. I didn't think it was funny. Thursday, 10:02 p.m. I was on the phone again, this time with Shauna Perrault, the police commissioner. I remembered when she earned that honor. Note the word, earned. It wasn't handed to her because she was a woman in a man's world, like most bitches who get high-ranking jobs. Shauna was the real deal, not some affirmative action entitlement piece of shit getting a job over some hard-working stiff who made the poor career choice of being born a white male.
Frank, did he give you a code?
Yes. I didn't say any more. I didn't want to. I'd recognized the bagman's voice. I was almost 100% sure my ass was fried.
Well,
Shauna said.
What was it?
I swallowed. I didn't want this to happen. I knew the game. The bagman always called the cops and gave them a code. He gave that same code to the victim. Even after 2 years of killings, the fucking cranks were still calling 911, claiming the bagman had called them and that they needed protection. His codes solved that problem. He was a damn courteous kid. Thing was, the codes became more of a warning to the cops than a way to separate out the sick, attention-starved loonies. The cops wanted to confirm the bagman's targets. Not so that they could stop him, but so they could stay the hell out of his way. My mouth was dry. I wanted a drink. I wanted drinks, plural as plural got. But I hadn't decided if I wanted to spend my last 17 hours on Earth, 3 sheets to the wind. I closed my eyes. It was time to find out if this was for real. Tweety, Sylvester, Daffy, I said. I waited, then opened my eyes. Shauna didn't say anything. I knew, once and for all, that I was a dead man.
I'm sorry, Frank.
I heard the despair in her voice. I couldn't blame her. 2 years of watching this circus freak kill people at will would be enough to exhaust any cop. Yeah, I said. Me too.
What did you do? Why is he coming after you?
I don't know.
Claudette Peters.
I know I've been a shit. You don't win a Pulitzer by being nice. But I haven't done anything to deserve this.
In the back of my head, I wondered if there was something, some forgotten sin, some repressed memory. But I couldn't dredge anything up from my swampy mind.
Frank, you know the deal. If you want police protection, I can't deny it. But I urge you to think that over strongly. You could be causing the death of good men.
That was how bad it had become in the past 18 months. The cops wouldn't go near the bag man unless they were ordered. Even then, most of them just quit instead. Nobody blames them now. It's one thing to lay your life on the line in the name of duty. It's quite another to risk death knowing there's absolutely nothing you can do. Nobody wants to die, especially the way the bag man kills you. Death by massive brain hemorrhaging. No external wounds, no broken bones, no internal bleeding other than the head. Coroners said the victim's brains looked like they'd been cooked in a microwave. A real mess. I saw one of those brains. Microwave wasn't my choice of descriptive kitchen appliances. I preferred a blender set on puree. I saw a coroner open up a victim's skull with one of those spooky bone saws. Fucker's brains spilled out like a damn milkshake. I wasn't surprised to see most everyone lose their lunch, of course, but the coroner puked. The coroner! You know it's some sick-ass shit when the fucking coroner pukes. The first 4 or 5 victims had everyone stumped. City authorities had no idea what caused such bizarre deaths. The CDC sent a team down and everything. Then the calls for help started coming in. Word gets around on the street, and seeing as the bag man gave everyone 18 hours to live, people talked. It didn't take long for the story to spread. By the 20th victim, even diehard gangsters were calling the cops for help. Sure, the strange killings made the news, but no one knew what we had on our hands. Not until Rocco Pizza Face Salvatore called the cops for protection. Told the DA he'd give up everything he had on the Capizzi family. Everything. The DA almost shit himself. All the cops had to do was keep him alive. The cops guarded Salvatore like he was the president that night. Even squirreled him away to a safe house. The protection, the move, it didn't matter. The bagman showed up at the appointed hour and turned Salvatore's brain to oatmeal. 2 cops died that night, too. The bagman ignored their bullets, ignored them until they tried to tackle him. Then he touched those cops, and they died.
Frank,
Shauna said,
did you hear me? Do you want police protection or not?
Her voice sounded shaky. If I asked, she had to send the cops. None of them would volunteer. Not anymore. 12 cops with pureed brains assured that. No, I said. Forget it, Shauna. No cops. She breathed a sigh of relief. Insensitive as hell, but I didn't hold it against her.
Frank, I'm authorized to give you a gun. Anything you want.
I've seen you guys shoot a fucking bazooka at him, I said. It won't make a difference.
The gun's not for the bag man. It's for you.
Now there was a little detail I'd missed in 2 years of covering this story. The cops were willing to give people guns. Suicide instead of facing the bag man. How's that for civil rights? My diehard reporter nature should have jumped on the angle like a bum on a bologna sandwich. but that part of me was dead already. It died the minute the bagman said he was coming for me. Hard to care about the news when you won't be alive to see tomorrow's evening edition. No, I said. No gun. I hung up. Shauna didn't call back. Friday, 9:32 a.m. It's funny how much time I spent on the phone my last few hours. Ironic, really. People say the pen is mightier than the sword. Nah, that's bullshit. Words aren't a reporter's real weapon. You do the most damage with a phone. Hours and hours and hours on the phone, calling contact after contact. Call one guy to follow up a lead, get a name, call another guy, get a name, call another guy, set up a meeting. At that meeting, what do you get? More names and numbers. Any asshole can spew words. Too many of my colleagues think their dainty little fingers type out brilliant prose that wows the audience. Bullshit. All people want is the story. Any schmuck can string together a few sentences around some nice, tasty facts. It's not like we're T.S. Eliot, although some of the conceited, arrogant bastards who fight for a byline or write for the latest douchebaggy website seem to think they are. Talent, vocabulary, Ivy League education, high IQ, guts. None of that is the secret sauce. For the real journalists, there's only one talent in the reporting field: getting the story. 99 times out of 100, getting the story means talking on the phone until your ear is all hot and your elbow hurts. After a lifetime with phones, from the old rotary to the push button to the cordless to the cell, I guess I couldn't quit. I called my ex-wife Sheila at work the next morning. Hadn't talked to her in 4 months. She was pissed because she divorced me back when I was making reporter wages. Peanuts. Now I had a Pulitzer under my belt and a bona fide New York Times number one bestseller about the bagman's childhood. I had money falling out of my ass. The greatest joy that money gave me? That Sheila didn't get any of it.
Pratchett Enterprises, Sheila McMillan speaking.
She'd kept her married name. Never could figure that one out. Hi, Toots. She loved being called Toots when we were married. At least until she found out that's what I also called all the other women I was fucking. She kind of hated it after that.
Hello, Frank.
Her voice held that odd mix of ice and familiar warmth only an ex-wife can master.
I haven't talked to you in months. How's life in the fast lane?
Great. I wanted to get this over with fast. It wasn't like I had much time. Listen, Sheila, there's something I want to tell you.
Oh, sounds serious, Frank. You never were too good at serious.
I know. Listen, Sheila, I wanted to say that when we were together, I really loved you. I've never loved anyone but you. I screwed up things for us both, and I wanted to tell you that I was wrong. And I'm sorry. She was silent for a moment. Then her voice became shaky and weak.
Frank, I don't know what to say.
The coldness in her voice was gone. Now there was only shock. I knew why. We'd known each other for 20 years, spent 6 of them married, and I don't think she ever once heard me say, "I'm sorry," to anyone about anything. She started to say something else, but I hung up. I sat back in the Lazy Boy and clicked on the TV. Rerun of Grey's Anatomy. The phone rang. I knew it was Sheila. I didn't answer. Friday, 11:34 a.m. 7-year-old
Tommy Archer, from the South Side. Died in a drive-by. The kid never did anything to anyone. Just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the wrong place could have been anywhere. Any time of day in this fucked-up city. Stray shot from a 12-gauge blew his head clean off. I saw the pictures. Hell, I was the one who broke the story. That was the Pulitzer. In the first months of the Bagman's reign, he was the biggest story on the planet. Everyone was trying to figure out why bullets didn't stop him, why he didn't burn when they turned a flamethrower on him, how he could get into any building, any prison, any fortress at the appointed time. Things like that. He was so inhuman with these weird powers that no one stopped to see him as a little boy. No one except me. He always looked blurry on film or on TV, never clear. But if you saw him in person, and I had 37 times in the past year alone, you could recognize his face. I've seen him more than anyone outside of the police department. What can I say? I'm an old guard senior reporter who used to go out drinking Manhattans with the chief of police. Membership has its privileges. Took me 4 weeks of looking through archived articles of every story concerning young white boys. 4 weeks, 12 hours a day, staring at newspaper clippings. I didn't write a single story in that time. Almost got fired. It was worth it. Worth it is spelled Pulitzer, by the way. I broke that story. Tommy Archer, 7-year-old victim of urban violence, back from the dead to kill sinners. Friday, 12:02 p.m. No one complained anymore, not even the liberals. Police did everything possible, tried every weapon, even brought in psychics and parapsychologists, if you can believe that. Those charlatan schmucks couldn't do anything either. Sick fucking world we live in, full of sick people. The Bagman became my only beat. I covered him day in and day out. I wasn't the only one. Every major metro has a reporter in this city, including a dozen European papers and rags as far away as Japan and South Africa. Everyone loves watching American scumbags bite the bullet. I have to admit, I kind of like it too. At least I did, until Tommy called me. So there's around 50 online and broadcast reporters who do nothing but cover the Bagman. Even a few poor saps who still work in print. His day-to-day killings don't make much of a media splash anymore. Don't do much but cause grief and humiliation for the victim's family as reporters scramble to find out what the poor bastard did wrong. You never know when he's going to off a celebrity. When he does, it's news. Guess I'm a celebrity now. I'll be good for a few headlines myself. Yeah. About 50 people covering the Bagman, but I've got an advantage. I lived in this city before little Tommy got rolling. That's how I started my bestseller. Got a tip from Shauna Peralt that Hasbro, the toy company, was filing all these Freedom of Information Act requests with the police department, trying to get a clear picture of Tommy's face. Took me 3 weeks to get the story, but I got it. They wanted to make dolls. Dolls! Can you believe that? This supernatural, freaky dead boy is turning people's brains into porridge, and Hasbro wants to turn him into a Cabbage Patch Kid or something. I cracked the story wide open. It drew gobs of national attention. Hasbro quickly forgot about the plan. Didn't matter. Sweatshops made the dolls anyway, and they sold like hotcakes. Bagman shirts, hats, greeting cards with the clever slogan, "Don't answer the phone." People were making a killing off Tommy. Pardon the pun. Like I said,
a sick fucking world. Anyway, I wrote a book about Hasbro and Tommy and the tragedy of a murdered young boy and a bunch of other bullshit that made people say, "We've got to do something about this world," motivated them to host fundraisers, to occupy politicians' offices, to participate in a dozen other activities that don't do a goddamn thing but make the participants feel like they actually matter, like they can have some impact on this world. Well, they don't matter. But the book sold a lot of copies. I got rich. The book had a happy ending for me, at least. Friday, 12:37 p.m. I tried to reach my daughter at her college. Hadn't talked to her in weeks. We're not very close. She's living with this black guy. Not that I care, mind you, but it's still unsettling, even if you're not a racist. She's in college, you know? You worry about rapists. Claudette Peters. You wonder if this black guy is a good man, or if he's ghetto trash getting a free ride to college because of the color of his skin. You wonder if he's going to take her, whether she wants it or not. Got her answering machine. I left a regular message. Told her I loved her. She'd find out the rest soon enough. Friday, 2:54 p.m. The doorbell rang. Can you believe that? He rang the doorbell. Little fucker could get into any building, anytime, anywhere, and at my house, he rang the doorbell. I wasn't getting up to let him in, though. Fuck him. He was there to kill me, after all. There was no point in playing games. No point in running or hiding. When your time was up, the bag man found you. No one knew how. He just did it. Some people ran, some hid, some fought. They all died. Me? I preferred not to waste my last few minutes in some useless dash for survival that wasn't coming. I'd covered this story for 2 years. I'd seen the shit people had pulled to stay away from the bagman. None of it ever worked. I remember the best one of all. The incident that really let us know there was no way to stop Tommy Archer. Vincent Emil was a rich bastard, a Croatian immigrant who made a killing in real estate deals, owned the Quickie Burger restaurant chain, even owned a minor league baseball team in Kansas, of all places. Pompous bastard, I can tell you that for free. Wore a lot of jewelry, Italian silk suits, that kind of thing. He got the call just over a year ago. Did he panic? Not Emil. No way. He had his private pilot fuel his private jet. Then he called me. He said he was going to be the first to outrun the bagman, that he'd be at 10,000 feet at the appointed hour. He invited me along. Vincent Emil wanted the world to know that he wasn't going to be bagged by anyone. Craziest shit I ever saw. We were at 9,500 feet. Emma was laughing his head off, drunk on life, elated that he'd escaped certain death. Then the bathroom door opened. Tommy came out. Kid didn't say a word. He walked right up to Emma and touched the guy's head. Emma dropped dead on the spot. Tommy walked back to the bathroom and shut the door. It was only then that I realized I'd shit myself. No one went near that bathroom. We landed 25 minutes later. A cop finally opened the bathroom door. Tommy was gone, of course. He'd somehow boarded a plane while it flew at 9,500 feet, did his thing, then disembarked. Crazy shit. Crazy kid. No way to outrun him. No way at all. So I sat there in my lazy boy, waiting in as much comfort as I could muster. My house, my things. No running for this old reporter. I had, however, decided to have those drinks. Plural. The bagman was here for me, and I was good and smashed. "It's open, Tommy, old boy." The handle turned. The door opened. And there he was, smiling politely with his perpetually missing left incisor. It would never grow back, because the kid didn't age as far as anyone could tell. I wondered if he'd cashed in with a tooth fairy before his head absorbed that rogue slug. He shut the door, wiped his feet on the throw rug, then walked into the living room. There was a rosy glow on his cheeks. His straight blonde hair was caught somewhere between combed and wild. It's a look only little boys can carry well because they don't try. It just happens. I wondered if that's what his hair had looked like before the slug ripped through his head like a screwdriver through a tomato. No trace of that wound, by the way. Tommy's head looked just as normal as any other little boy's. I'd drunk a bottle of Southern Comfort to blur things. It hadn't worked. Somehow, I was suddenly sober, despite the liquor. I'm sure that was his doing. I'd meant to ask him why he called himself the bagman. Some last act, eh? No one knew. We assumed it was because he bagged people, as in body bag. Like I said, I meant to ask him, but when he walked through my door, it just didn't seem to matter. "Hello, Mr. McMillan," the bagman said.
"Hiya, Tommy."
I wanted to run, but that wouldn't do any good. It was 3:03. I'd watched this scene many times as an impartial observer. No one got away from Tommy Archer, the bagman. I offered the bottle to him. "Care for a swig?"
"No thanks, Mr. McMillan."
He just stared at me. He had the face, hair, body, and gap-toothed smile of an innocent 7-year-old. But his eyes were something else. They seemed very old. Older than me.
"Tommy, are you sure there hasn't been some mistake?"
There was a whine in my voice I hadn't heard since Sheila walked out on me. I'd promised myself I wasn't going to beg, that I would die like a man. So much for promises. I was never that good at them anyway.
"You're a liar, Mr. McMillan," Tommy said. "You've hurt a lot of people in your job. Printed stories you knew weren't true just because they were sensational. You've made quite a name covering me, but before you won that Pulitzer, you were not a very nice reporter, sir."
"There's no such thing as a nice reporter. The only nice people write that useless social page shit, those feature story puff pieces. I'm a hard news man, Tommy."
I whipped the bottle at him. It went right through his head and smashed into the wall on the far side. Shards of glass sparkled in the flickering light of the television.
"Uzis don't work on him, but I could hurt him with a half-empty fifth of liquor. Yeah, right."
I felt tears coming down my cheeks. If my ass hadn't been socked in the Lazy Boy, I'm sure I would have been on my knees. "Come on, Tommy. I was a scumbag reporter for years, sure, but that's not any reason to kill a man."
"No, it's not," Tommy said. "That's not why I'm here. You remember Claudette Peters, don't you, Mr. McMillan?"
I suddenly felt colder than I ever had in my life, including my cub reporter days when I had that beat in Anchorage. From the moment I'd heard his voice the night before, I'd known why the bagman was coming for me. I'd known. I just hadn't allowed myself to remember. For 32 years, I had blocked that memory. But as soon as he spoke her name, I couldn't stop the scene from flooding back into my thoughts.
"Tommy! Tommy, that was 32 years ago! I was a drunk kid, for God's sake!"
Tommy shrugged.
"I don't care if you were drunk or sober, sir. You raped her."
I broke. The tears came,
uncontrollable. I'd raped her? Please, she'd wanted it, flaunted her body in that "you so wish you could fuck me" outfit, then played games with me. What a little cock tease. But she'd tried that on the wrong guy, hadn't she? I hit her. Only once. But it was enough. Took the fight right out of her. In a drunken stupor, I'd taken Claudette's virginity by force. I almost told Tommy it was just a date rape. But I didn't bother. The mere fact that he was here, in my living room, meant I was already dead. There is no court of appeals. There is no bargaining with the bagman. She killed herself last week, Mr. McMillan, Tommy said. She never married, never had kids. Since the night you raped her, she could never trust anyone. Counseling didn't help her. Nothing did. It's unusual for such an event to cause such a high degree of trauma, Mr. McMillan, but it destroyed her life. And you're to blame. I felt the tears on my cheeks, felt the snot hanging from my nose. I took a drink, even though I knew it would do nothing for me. I was 19 years old, Tommy. It was a frat party. I was drunk. This is true, Mr. McMillan. But it's still a sin, and you've got to pay for it. There's no one else out there to kill? No one worse than me? Tommy smiled. They're all gone, Mr. McMillan. I work hard. You were one of the people who cheered me on while I cleansed the city of that scum. I read your articles in the beginning. Read how you said it was good riddance to bad rubbish. That someone had to get rid of these criminals anyway. I like that good riddance line. It sounds old-fashioned, but I like it. All the good people like yourself loved me until all the really bad people were gone, and I moved on to the only a little bit bad people. No one liked that because everyone is a little bit bad, wouldn't you say, Mr. McMillan? You knew some of those little bit bad people. They weren't gangbangers or assassins. They were neighbors, friends, and co-workers. But they were also pedophiles and child abusers. They beat their wives. They cheated on their taxes. They conned people. And they were also rapists, like you. And now it's your turn. It's 3 p.m., Mr. McMillan. He stepped toward me. I shut my eyes. I didn't want to see it coming. I heard his hands vibrating thickly like a dozen bumblebees trapped in chocolate pudding. I felt a tingle on my forehead. His hands came for my head, but I didn't think about myself. All I could focus on was Claudette Peters and those tears of fear and pain and betrayal that streaked her face 32 years before. I remembered her now. Every last detail.
Author's note for Bagman: let he who is without sin cast the first stone. I'm not a religious man, but I'm not so blind that I can't see the societal value of many elements of the Bible and other religious texts. If you look at the Ten Commandments as nothing but a way to build a productive society, one that keeps workers in the fields and factories instead of killing each other over various transgressions, it's solid. The phrase means that we have all done bad things. Bad is a relative term, of course. Have you ever killed a guy? Well, no, of course not. Not since that incident at Stuckey's back in 78, but it's okay, I won't tell anyone. So you haven't committed murder, but have you ever stolen? Ever? Not even a pencil in grade school? Have you ever lied? You know lying is in the thou shalt nots, right? Have you ever coveted? Born false witness? Maybe you've done some of those things. So, no, you haven't killed a guy, but odds are that you have done something that would run afoul with the good word.
Or say you live under another set of rules, one that says homosexuals must be put to death. One that says if you, woman, try to be with a man you want to be with, you can be beaten halfway to death or maybe all the way. Maybe a set of rules that says you can't eat at a lunch counter, sit in the front of the bus, or drink out of a particular fountain. Or maybe even a set of rules that says it's fine to own another human being. The point of Bagman is that wrong is a relative term based on the society and time in which you live. Things that you do today could have gotten you ostracized, imprisoned, or even killed a few centuries ago. Maybe you believe in establishing a firm set of rules for which capital punishment is valid. Maybe it is. I'm not arguing that. But the slippery slope is what happens when there's a new sheriff in town and the crimes that merit the death penalty change. Someone who's banging the drum for the gallows to drop might find herself standing on that same platform a few months later. Granted, the story doesn't work if our protagonist stole a pencil in the third grade. It does work, however, if we choose a vile yet debatable crime. Should he be held accountable for something that happened at a drunken frat party some 3 decades earlier? Should he be punished? Possibly. Should he be executed? Well, that just depends on who's passing judgment, doesn't it? If it was your daughter who committed the same crime and faced the punishment, what would you say? If you were the judge, what verdict would you pass down? In our hypothetical tale of morality, Frank McMillan finds out how the sliding scale of justice can swing his way. When the real criminals are gone, doesn't the machine still need criminals? You know what they say, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. And if justice has all the time in the world, don't be surprised if someday you find your feet standing on that gallows door. And that was Bagman. I hope you guys enjoyed the story. I recorded this episode early. 2 weeks early, to be precise, before I left for my Michigan visit. While you are listening to the story at this very second right now, I am in the future probably partaking in some tuna noodle casserole made by my mom, sitting my butt on the couch watching the Lions or watching NFL in general, just kind of overdosing on family and football. It is great. As soon as I get back, couple days in San Francisco, then Dark Overlord is heading to Las Vegas for Sigler Fest 2K13. It is the high holidays at the Lair of Doom. I'm still writing, but I can't wait to see everyone coming out to Sigler Fest. This year, we've got 3 entire families coming to Sigler Fest. I never thought I would be the provider of family-friendly entertainment, but you grow up, you live and learn, and there you go. We're going to have the Canisheros, we're going to have the Haney Boys, and the Harveys, all making Sigler Fest a respectable family affair. There will be a significantly reduced amount of nudity this year, unless it happens to be some babies who are getting their diaper changed from the poopy pants. But that's not the same kind of nudity you expect in Vegas. Again, live and learn, moving on up. The MVP hardcover limited edition run has only about 50 copies remaining. When they are gone for good. We get emails every week, people asking for their copies of The Rookie and of The All-Pro, which are sold out in hardcover. We don't have any. They're not available. They're only available in the aftermarket on Amazon.com and the Libris and eBay. Most of the time, those books are going for $200 to $300. So when they're gone, they're gone. If you want that hardcover MVP for your collection, you got to go to scottsigler.com/store and get it now. Coming up, I will have the promo for Liberate, a Continuum podcast. That's LIBER and the number 8. But first, ladies and gentlemen, I told you I would be announcing the tour stops for the pandemic tour in January. We'll be kicking off January 18th or 19th in San Francisco. Then we will be in Chicago, then Boston, then Philly, then Baltimore, then Nashville, then all the way back across country to Los Angeles, California. I do not have specific dates for those events just yet. We will be announcing them very soon. Once again, San Francisco, Chicago, Boston, Philly, Baltimore, Nashville, and Los Angeles. I told you in last week's episode, we're the ones funding this tour, so we can't just add cities willy-nilly. So if we didn't get your city this time out, sorry about that. It's the best we can do. We are choosing to put the publisher's money into a PR firm, which is going to try and get greater awareness for Pandemic and the entire Infected trilogy. Hopefully that will have a bigger impact than adding four or five more cities. Yes, I am going to miss you in your town. Also, you could come to Sigler Fest if you really wanted to come and hang out for a day. And it's also Vegas, which is sweet. Maybe we will be touring more for books after Pandemic, but I really doubt it. A book tour is a great time. I love to see all the junkies, love to hang out with y'all, love to go to the bar after, but it is a practice kind of diminishing returns. So touring is, number one, it is a bottom line expense for Dark Overlord Media, and we have to weigh that as a small business if it produces enough of a return for us to keep doing that. Number two, all that time touring is time we're not writing, we're not making new stories for you guys. So it's kind of a long-winded way to say, sorry, I'm not in your town. You can tweet me, email me, Facebook me, Google Plus me, Tumblr me, anything you want to say, yes, but what about my town? My town is fantastic. I know that your town is fantastic, and we will not be going there. Unless your town is San Francisco, Chicago, Boston, Philly, Baltimore, Nashville, or Los Angeles, California. That's it for this week. I leave you now with the Liberate promo for their Continuum podcast, and I will talk to you all real soon.
Hey, this is Mike and Dave from Liberate, a Continuum podcast at continuumpodcast.com.
And our future selves came back in time to tell us we need to get more listeners because apparently in 2020, Continuum is just a few viewers shy of a new record for the highest rated, longest running Canadian sci-fi show in history.
Yeah, plus they told us that our podcast will eventually interview all of the various cast members, but they still haven't scored one with Rachel Nichols. So help us out, will you?
Listen to Liberate, a Continuum podcast with Mike and Dave.
Subscribe on iTunes or go to continuumpodcast.com.
The future is in your hands.
You have been listening to The Bones Are White, serialized short story audiobook, written by Scott Sigler. This audiobook was produced by A. Kovacs and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. For more information on the author or to hear his free weekly fiction podcast, go to scottsigler.com. Theme music is the song Greed by the band Separation of Sanity.
I am a creeping cancer, rots you to the core, pumping through your blackened heart, such a